everybody. It's Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. You're on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you things to talk about, things to think about, things to consider. Hopefully that if you learn enough, hear enough, understand enough, you'll be able to live a more positively minded life. We get a little bit of a split around here because half the time we're talking about psychological things and half the other half of the time we're talking about this other aspect, which is this journey into the inner self, trying to find the what some people call the higher self, the enlightened being. Today we want to look at the feeling of emptiness. Emptiness, what is that like? You need someone to fill your emptiness. That's what a lot of people are doing with their lives. They spend their lives having somebody fill that feeling of emptiness so they don't feel that emptiness. Where's your emptiness? You know, so the feeling of emptiness is something to look at. If we spend all our lives keeping busy, I had a friend the other day who said to me, I should be doing everything but what I'm doing now. And what I'm doing now is basically filling the emptiness. I'm just doing things to do things. Almost like the emptiness is something to be feared. My guest, Dr. Robert Gunn, who is the author of a book called Journeys into Emptiness, which is about three famous masters and their quest for transformation. And we're going to have him talk to us because here's the question. You know that feeling called loss? What about the company it keeps with a mind-numbing sense of instability? It's really doing a number on quite a few of us, and I barely made it. If it comes to the idea, what do you do with that feeling of emptiness? Do you go to your therapist? What do you do? Well, here to talk about some of the things that he has learned and some of the things that other people have learned is Dr. Robert Gunn. Robert, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you. Thank you for that great introduction to the subject of emptiness. I couldn't put it better myself. That really gets us into the picture of what it's like. Do we need love? How do we feel empty? How is it that we manage to spend our whole lives doing things that don't really feel like they fill us? And so we wind up at the end of the day feeling really empty inside.
Is that the idea, though? The idea is that we're doing things that don't fill us, that if we did the right things, they would fill us and we wouldn't feel empty?
I think that's what we all think, is if we only get the right thing, if we only get the right person, if we only get the right job, then we won't feel empty anymore.
Well, is that the story, though? Is that the truth of it? Is the idea here not to feel empty, or is the idea here?
Well, I think that there are three stages of emptiness in the psycho-spiritual path. And so what we start out as an emptiness that's about a feeling of loss or of not having, a feeling of dissatisfaction, discontent, you know, like our life does not really have any purpose or meaning. That's really the beginning of a whole journey of a lifetime. And if we address that emptiness and try to find a way to come to terms with it, we're on for a journey that will open up all kinds of possibilities, and we'll find ourselves very filled and at the same time learn a new meaning of emptiness. The new meaning of emptiness that we wind up is something that we've gotten mostly from the Eastern traditions. And my book, Journeys into Emptiness, picks up on the life of Dogen Zenji, the founder of Soto School of Zen Buddhism. And where that takes us is emptiness as the unity of all things, how everything is really connected, and you are part of everything. You're part of that unity. Once you discover that point about your life, you're no longer hurting in the same way. You find a satisfaction and a peace and a joy that connects you with everything. It doesn't mean the pain goes away always, because that's part of life, but it means you feel more deeply satisfied inside.
So at the beginning of your search, you go, "Oh, yeah, I feel empty." And at the end of your search, you go, "I feel empty." Is that
that's
the whole thing?
That's excellent. That's the sum of it all. Thank you. That's 350 pages right there.
You want to go from oi to ah.
Exactly.
Now, how to get there, to go from oi to ah.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of words, these two powerful.
Not only a lot of words, but a lot of effort and a lot of discipline. If we're going to take our lives seriously, then we have to look at the things that are most painful and that we're most afraid to face. That's the difficult part. We spend most of our lives running away from pain, running away from things that are a problem. You know, relationships are not fulfilling because we don't know how to really connect with each other. So that's why we feel empty inside. We don't know how to connect. But that's what the business of psychotherapy is about, is helping people connect with each other, helping them connect with themselves on a deeper way.
My guest, Dr. Robert, is that pronounced Jingen?
Yes.
Jingen?
Jingen.
Robert Jingen Gunn, G-U-N-N, who's written a book called Journeys into Emptiness. Having studied the masters, a psychotherapist himself, he kind of studied the masters as a Jungian student. He went back and started studying some of the very deeply influential people, Merton, Dogen, Jung, and tried to see what they had to say along their path, because there's always this problem, you know, Robert, there's always this problem. You've got the secular life and you've got the spiritual life, and you try to get the two of them to work together. And you got Jung, who's got having all of these affairs while he's trying to figure out where does love fit into the formula, and the same with all the others. They're trying to, where does love fit in? We're going to get to all of that today, because that's what I want to look at. Talk about three stages of emptiness, the first being vulnerability, or this feeling of that people go in with a complaint, right, Robert?
Yes.
Emptiness is painful. That's step one.
Right.
Then comes step two and step three. What are the two steps you said? The third one you said is ecstasy. Emptiness is bliss.
Right.
What's step two?
Step two is what happens in between. That's your life. Step two is the point at which we decide that we really want to live a different way. We want to have a life that's filled with more meaning, a life that has more satisfaction. We want to heal this ache inside, this emptiness that is so painful. And part of the pain is that we don't know what to do with it, and we don't know what to do with our lives. So to go through to the other side of it, we have to embark on the journey. We have to make a decision to take our lives seriously, to make a decision that we want more out of our lives. And when we do that, we have to do some letting go. We have to recognize that there's going to be a cost. You can't get to the bliss without paying a price. And the price may be money. It may be time. It may be a relationship that you've been clinging on to and you didn't really like it. It wasn't very fulfilling, but you hang in with it because you're afraid of being all alone. To pay the price means being willing to let go of some of these things that mean so much to us, things like security, maybe your job, it may be your house or your car. You may have to change your life. So the second stage of emptiness is about that letting go. It's emptying yourself.
My image of a Buddhist, which I know you are somewhat practicing Buddhist without the robes, right?
Yes, yeah.
Right? So my idea, therefore, is that you must have the philosophy, let go of all of your attachments.
Well,
if it's an attachment and you're struggling with it, let it go.
You have to decide whether it's one worth holding on to or letting go. You don't know automatically what you need to hold on to.
Was there anything you have to hold on to? Tell me something you must hold on to from a Buddhist perspective. You know, your wallet?
Not your wallet. As much as possible, hold on to your life. But even that, potentially everything is up for grabs.
So there is, if everything is up to grabs, everything has potential to be let go.
Yes.
Does anything have potential to be held on to? I'm sorry to hit you with the tough questions, but I meant to ask this to Mark Epstein. I meant to ask it to Nicholas Vreeland when he was here. So if you don't have to let go, because it looks to me like all they keep saying is let go of everything. What I think you hold on? You hold on to your discipline. You hold on to your dedication. You hold on with such a dedication, and you say, I will not hurt any sentient beings, right? I will not be part of hurting any sentient beings.
Oh, that's impossible.
And
a fly is
biting you,
no,
right?
No. You can't get away with that. It's impossible to live without hurting sentient beings. It's impossible to live without killing. It's a whole bag. You cannot live without, in some way, taking life. So the only question is, doing it as consciously as possible and as selectively as possible for a purpose. So, you know, I mean, some people are vegetarians because they don't want to kill cows. I always wonder how they feel about plants. Plants, too, are living things. And so it's a matter of how you, what kind of consciousness you bring to what you're doing.
Okay, so we won't go there. So we know. Okay. So we understand this question. We understand there's a question of emptiness that we're approaching, right? This emptiness is an important thing because the feeling of emptiness is what everybody has had to deal with. Let's go back in time. Let's see the first one that you studied, right? Dogen. What did he teach you? Or what did you learn from studying him?
Perseverance, first of all. Dogen was a very, very determined guy. He had this question that was burning inside himself because from his earliest memory, he had no father and his mother died when he was 6 years old. So he was left all alone in the world pretty much.
What year is this? When is this?
Dogen was born in 1200 AD in Japan. And grew up as we might say an aristocratic in an aristocratic family, very, very bright from an early age. He was reading and writing Chinese and read Sanskrit in a much later time in his life, and he persevered in his question. So if you want to answer the question of what to hold on to your questions, hold on to your dream of bliss, your dream of a sense of wholeness in life, a dream of being connected.
Is that what Dogen did?
He did, yeah.
What did he do?
I mean, the way he did it was the time there was through Zen Buddhism. And so he became a monk and studied with all of the masters that he could in Japan. He wasn't satisfied. He went all the way to China.
What was he looking for?
He was looking for a sense of contentment and a sense of connectedness to all of life.
Maybe he needed to meet a nice gal. Well, did he along the way, by the way? Did romance come into his picture?
It's hard to find out from 1200 AD, you know, exactly about people's affairs. We're much more revealing of ourselves now. There's no indication, really, that Dogen had that kind of relationship with anyone, but it's also hard to escape the idea that he did.
See, it's a problem I run into a whole bunch of people. Almost everyone I know who has ever been a dedicated Buddhist has said that – let me just take that back. Almost everyone I know who's been a dedicated Buddhist has in any way – it seems to have meager personal relationships. Meager. They seem to be – the idea is – they're somewhere, they feel really fraught about the love issue, and I've never met a great Buddhist who has a great love life. You know, I've just never met it. They always seem to be the same. They say, I let go completely. Now, this may mean that the great love life means me and my wife or me and my partner, we're two separate beings and we're totally separate. We don't hang out with each other much, but we have this profound love. But as a personal, interpersonal relationship, I rarely see the Buddhist who can embrace love. I see the ones who are letting go of everything. And I suspect sometimes that the rationale for being a Buddhist is because you're afraid of being loved or loving.
That's a very common point of view from our, you know, psychologically informed modern age. And I think it's a question that everybody has, especially they ask about all of these celibate priests and, you know, what are they doing? How can they teach me about love and marriage when they haven't experienced it themselves? So I think that we all ask that question, but I think it would be very misleading if we understood Buddhism as running away from the body, running away from the flesh, running away from desires.
Or it could be the opposite. Or it could be the Buddhist that looks at us and says, you know, there's a whole problem. You're always looking for relationship. You're looking for love. Love is completely, it's completely meaningless. Romance in the form that you have it is completely meaningless. Give up that and go to God instead, and you'll find true peace. That's the other perception.
Right, and I think that's equally misguided. That's the value of depth psychology to our contemporary understanding. Depth psychology helps us understand that we have to have a self in order to be in a relationship. One of the things that Jung said is that two halves do not make a whole. So if you're not a complete person and your partner's not a complete person, the relationship is not going to be a complete relationship. You're going to be two people that are trying to fill each other up, but you have nothing to give.
Well, now your other two travelers here, you call Gustav Jung, right, Robert Merton, both of those, did either of those have a happy love life?
Thomas Merton had a very unsatisfactory love life, I would say, before he went to the monastery. And if we trace his history and his writings at the monastery in Gethsemane in Kentucky, we find him working on a lot of internal images of women, some direct relationships with his editors, but it wasn't until he was almost 50 years old that he actually fell in love in a way that was very transforming for him.
So old.
We should be so lucky.
50, so old. But no, along the way. So what were these images that he had?
Merton had what he reported, at least, as a very distant and critical mother. And his images, his dreams, and the way he talks about women are more as we would call it nowadays objects, more as things than as actual human beings that he could relate to and have a mutual relationship with. He didn't know how to do that until much later in life.
Well, that's funny. Didn't Jung have the same experience with his mother?
Jung's mother, Jung's earliest memory is of his mother being in the hospital, probably because of depression.
Right. She was unavailable to him, too.
Right.
Well, wasn't Dojin's mother available also? Unavailable also?
She was very much there until she died when he was 6 years old.
So we got three guys with unavailable mothers?
Right.
Who are looking for God?
You think there's a connection?
I wonder.
Yeah, well, of course there's a connection. We always want to find the source of love. And we look to people. We look to things. We look to clubs, societies, other people. And as we get older and wiser, hopefully, we make better selections about people that actually are able to love us better.
Some of us find the ones who are able to love us the most and chase them away. Then we decide to take the Buddhist way, you know, when you get this is getting a little too close. I think I better go in the monastery. I think I better become a nun. Thomas Merton was Catholic, right?
He became Catholic, yes.
He became Catholic. What was the story, the religious story? Because he was one of the most prolific writers. He was one of the most important forces in our life. I mean, he was in contact with everybody, wasn't he? Didn't he convert the Pope to Judaism or something? No, he changed the Pope in some way.
Well, I think that Merton's contribution was in extending the great teachings of Vatican II into the rest of the world, and he was one of the people who made that possible and actually did it by his writings and his contacts with people around the world in the 60s, political figures, poets, writers, other and religious leaders, of course. But Merton, the question was about his relationship with women and his falling in love rather late in life was very transforming to him. And I think it opened up his heart in a way that never quite happened before. Before this experience, his religious writings are deep and profound, but they somehow don't have the fullness of compassion and the kind of open-heartedness that happened after this experience. It was profoundly meaningful to him.
How did it affect his journey towards making peace with the emptiness. You know, I mean, this is basically what the book is about and what he's about, mm-hmm. what he was about. So how did, what do you think happened? Do you think somebody said, so how's your quest for finding peace lately? And he says, I forgot about it. I had to go get my wife flowers.
Merton's a most interesting character. I don't think that he was ever at peace for very long with himself, because his mind was constantly reaching out for different things. He was always breaking the boundaries of the monastery. When he first went in there, people were not even allowed to talk. And he began writing, became famous with his Seven-Story Mountain sort of very early on, and became famous to the rest of the world, and began a correspondence that continued.
Yeah, I understand. If we were going to take this search into emptiness, you say emptiness is homelessness. Let's start there.
Right. I call emptiness a form of homelessness because the beginning of emptiness is about not having a place that you feel is safe and secure that you belong to. I think that this is a very common experience for us in the world nowadays. I was born in one place. I moved almost every year of my life until I was 14 or 15. I don't think my experience is that strange from other people's, and especially now with so much immigration going on, people change cultures, change countries, and so the question of where home is a very big question for everybody. Where do I really belong, and where do I feel secure? Where do I feel known? This is a real question and a spiritual question for everybody.
We have this fear of that feeling for some reason. Now, I suspect, Robert, that it really gets basic from early childhood, that we are taught to fill up everything. Fill up your mind, fill up your brain, fill up your knapsack, fill up everything. You know, fill up, you just got to keep filling things up. And I also think that emptiness is the devil's workshop, according to our parents, you know, that if you have an empty mind, you're going to start thinking evil thoughts. So they want you to do things. They want you to do your homework, do this, do that. What are you doing? Sitting there doing nothing, do the dishes. So we're trained early on to avoid this emptiness. And in fact, one of the worst feelings that you could have as a kid is to be hungry, because hunger is perceived as bad as well. If a person is hungry, feed it right away. That's why we're so fat, because, you know, it's the idea is you can't tolerate hunger. Hunger is something that you don't tolerate. You go fill it up right away. How are you feeling? Hungry. Here, have a bite of this. It's okay to be hungry. So maybe a practice is to allow ourselves to start, without going into a strong Buddhist discipline, to start letting ourselves feel emptiness wherever we can, just on a day-to-day level. Where is it? Where's the empty time? What are you doing? You know, if you're at work, where's the empty time? Where's that little space in your life? I think it was Eli Jackson Bear who said, it's about the spaces. It's about trying to find those wonderful spaces in between. Was it Eli? Somebody said it. He said, we're looking for the sacred spaces where nothing is happening, and we're looking to expand on those. An old friend of mine, Itzhak Bentov, do you know who he is? Mm-hmm. Wrote a book called Stalking the Wild Pendulum. He draws a pattern. He said, you know, you're on this planet one day, and then while you're on this planet, you have moments of emptiness. And he said, if you take those moments of emptiness and you expand them so that they're more profound each time, eventually, if you practice this, you're in two places at the same time. You're in the world of emptiness at the same time as you're in the world on the planet. And it's not just one or the other. You're not on the ground or in the emptiness. Because I know a lot of space heads who are just empty all the time. And they do that as a refuge. They do that as a way of running away. Drugs will take you to emptiness, but drugs will take you out of your body. Drugs will not bring you along with it. And I don't think that's the way to go. I don't think that's the idea. So we're searching for this, and we're searching by learning from a number of people and learning from ourselves. What do you think are the requirements that you got to have in order to take a spiritual journey?
I think there are four things that are crucial to take on your spiritual journey. The first one is that you need a kind of a container. It's so difficult to face these feelings of emptiness and really look at them and try to understand them. We need some way of feeling kind of held. And that can be a thing like a therapy appointment. It can be going to church. It can be taking your kids for a walk in the park. But you need some way of bracketing off some space and time in your life so that you can really let yourself have the experience of whatever you're experiencing.
So you think a ritualistic time selected is an important thing to do, whether it be therapy session, whether it be going to a church, whether it be sitting zazen, when it could be your 20-minute meditation, whatever it is, whatever time you do, you must take time, put it aside.
Right.
So you do it. And that's not just, is that going to the bar and having a few drinks? Is that it? Does that fit the requirement?
That's trying to fill up too much too fast. Although, you know, I'm not against people going to the bars. And sometimes you find what you need there. What can I say? But it is important to have a bracketed time and space in your life. That's the meaning of the Sabbath, you know, the seventh day that you put aside as holy and you do nothing. That's the point.
That could be part of the appeal of the gymnasiums, you know, of why workout places become such a thing, you know, why people go to gyms. I mean, what do they get there? They get this incredible experience of sitting on a bike or going on a rowing machine or taking a Stairmaster and virtually doing nothing, you know, going on a bicycle, going nowhere, Stairmaster climbing nowhere, right? But you're working your body and you have a reason to be there. There's a benefit. People say you're doing something while you're doing nothing. And in those moments, people have two choices. They could either think compulsively and think the way they always do, obsessively, about one thing or another, or they could clear their mind. And what a great place to clear your mind while you're working out. It's a decent choice. I knew a man who used to work 4 hours it took him to get to New York. He worked 4 hours away. He would have to get in a car, then he'd get to a train, then he'd travel 3 hours in from Long Island. 3 hours. He lived all the way out in Montauk to get to New York. And I said, why do you do this every day? He said, because it's my ritual. He said, I love it. I love that time. Of course, he hated his wife, which is another issue. He didn't want to be at home with his wife. But the main thing was he got these 4 hours to and fro where he found this sense of peace. Okay, so that's one item, bracketing, mm-hmm. right? What is the other? A container is what you call
right,
it.
Right, right. The second one is you need some kind of a teacher. You need somebody who knows the ropes, who's been there and can guide you through the chaos of your own mind and the conflicts that you are jumping yourself into.
Boy, that's such a hard one. Because everybody makes believe they've been there. You know, you turn on a TV and I'll give you 101 channels filled with somebody who's sitting up there and saying, I have been there. So finding a teacher is such a difficult thing because inevitably you're going to get disappointed. How many people have a teacher for life? Almost none. Because eventually they find out the teacher was a phony.
Well, I wouldn't say phony as much as has limits. I mean, maybe they are totally phony. There are, you know, there are charlatans out there. But for the most part, teachers and therapists just have limits.
And I think if that's accepted in advance, that this person's not going to be the answer to my dream, but this person is going to be somebody taking me partially along the way.
Right.
That makes
right.
it a lot easier. So it's a TFN is a good definition, teacher for now. Right? You're my
that's
teacher.
Good. That's
You're
good.
My teacher for now.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's true. And I think that's true even of many of our relationships. You know, our relationships carry us along a certain way, and hopefully we grow from them. Some relationships are meant to last for 5 minutes. Some are for days, years. Some are for very few are for a lifetime.
This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Robert Gunn. We are going to take a short break here at WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, my friends, in honor of our our early masters, I will play something else from Japan for you today. Here's a little something to stir your bones. And this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind with Dr. Robert Gunn, talking about the journey into emptiness, talking about trying to take emptiness, reform it, reshape it, redefine it so that life is a little more meaningful, so that it feels a little different. Okay, Robert, back to you. We have two things so far on this spiritual journey. We have the container, right, which is trying to find out what's there, trying to find out what some kind of ritual that we use. And then we have the teacher, trying to find the teacher, somebody who could help us in some way, guide us. Why can't you be your own teacher?
Because the mind is always creating things that will help us run away from the pain.
That's the mind's job.
Yeah.
So you're looking at yourself and you say, I'm now going to take on my own pain. It'll actually get you to divert to a different pain.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. If you're going to take on the pain of existential aloneness, right, it'll start getting you to worry about your children.
that's not a bad thing to worry about.
But worrying about it, you know what I mean?
You kind
of, some people I know have children just so they could have something to worry about.
Right.
So they could have something to occupy their minds. And that's why when children leave and become adults, you know, and they leave the home, the people fall apart because they've been filling themselves with that for so long.
The empty nest syndrome.
Yeah.
It's another kind of emptiness, making a play on that.
Empty nest syndrome, right?
Empty
nest syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, we want to fill it up. In order to go into that, in order to take on your spiritual journey, you also need some kind of a practice, not just a teacher, but your teacher is usually related to a practice. By practice, what I mean is it may be the rituals that you were talking about, certain things that you do that have an automaticity so that your mind is set free. If you go into the spiritual journey, the practice has to do with how do you make contact with something that's deeper than your pain? How do you make contact with your real self, with reality, with God, with your higher power? How do you do that? Prayer and meditation are the common things that are have been used down through the centuries. Nowadays, psychotherapy is also a practice. You have a practice of going in and talking about yourself. And your therapist is the teacher, basically, who kind of leads you down the labyrinthine paths to the source of the gold. So you need a practice, some repeated way of going deeper into your own life.
And this practice has to be a kind of a discipline, because if you say, I tried meditating once, but I fell asleep.
Right.
Right? And that's it. I fell asleep, therefore why meditate?
Right. Yeah.
Right. You need to be able to go say to yourself, I'm going back there over and over and over again.
That's right.
What if the problem you're trying to face is how to make a commitment? You know what I mean?
Well, this is where the teacher comes in. That's exactly right. Yeah, of course. That's what we all face. We need a teacher or a therapist or someone who's guiding us that we can receive enough support and who can give us the kind of understanding of what we're going through so that we can stick with it.
You know, one of the problems is many of us grow up and we make a decision at an early age that we're really in it alone. You know, I can think of three people in this room right now who made that decision. We're in it alone. It's up to us. We've got to find the solution. Nobody else is there. And in order to get through life, to grow up from that very early stage just to survive, you've had to believe, I can't depend on anybody. Now, if you believe I can't depend on anybody, and that's made you live as far as you've gone, and it's been your survival tool, it is such a big thing to step over and trust somebody.
Absolutely.
With your being, you know, trust somebody. I do consultations with people. I see people who have never seen a therapist because they listen to this station and they say, maybe he's a good guy. Because they know me, you know, they listen and they make sure they listen. Did he just say something bad about Italian people? Did he just say something? And they're listening closely, critical. And I let it hang out somewhat. But they finally decide they're going to come and see me. And they come and see me and you could see this dying yearning to trust. And at the same time having a giant battle inside that says, I cannot, I will not trust. I will not trust anyone because if I trust, and if it's okay to trust, then everything I believed from childhood on was a mistake. The thing that I had to distrust everybody. But somewhere in there, I think, you don't make that next step until you do.
Absolutely. But you also don't make it unless you find someone that gives you at least the hint that trust is possible. That's all we have to go on at first is a hint.
Yeah, watch me and let's see how far I get with you. You know, I'm not going to ask you to sign over your wallet. Don't tell me, don't go bury your money in your backyard. Don't go do that for me. But then that person, that guy takes you and guides you into your practice. And you may even go to them because you see, another thing I like about therapists is they're hired help. You know, we are plumbers, no different. We are carpenters.
That's
no
one of
different.
The nicest terms I've heard used for therapists.
Yeah, no, we are. We're hired help. Hired help. You fire us. You hire us. you fire us. You could look at your therapist at any point, stand up from your chair. You don't like the way your therapist is treating you. Say, you're fired, and walk out.
Right, absolutely.
You know, and I'm not even going to pay you for the last day's work because it was so bad, right? I ain't going to pay you for this past month because you did such a lousy job. And you fire the therapist and you walk out and you take your own power back. Because a lousy job is if you feel that way. If you feel like you want to fire your therapist, then the therapist is doing a lousy job. Somehow they're not tuned into you. Somehow they're not there. They may be challenging you in too harsh a way. They may be in some way being harmful to you. So you get to the point where you trust someone. That someone guides you and says, look, here's a practice, one that I believe in. Here's one that I believe could work. Either the practice will be coming to therapy or the practice will be what you do on your own. And on your own, here are the steps. Here's the places you got to go. Now, to deal with emptiness, is there a primary practice, Robert? Is there something that people need to do more than anything else? Do they need to sit zazen? What is a practice that's almost essential to get to the bottom of it, by what you understand?
Hmm. Well, that's a really good question. I think that some form of finding your way to a meditative state is really important. Some people, it might be fishing. Some people, like you mentioned, might be cab driving. Some people find it, as a scuba diver, I find, you know, people see scuba diving as a meditative activity. Or it can be more direct meditation that's taught by, you know, one of the religions. But you need some way of getting your mind into a frame of trusting and feeling safe and secure. Feeling like you don't have to do anything to prove yourself. So however you find that, some people it's a walk in the woods. However you find that is really important for you to cultivate. It's almost the same order of difficulty as following your bliss. You know that phrase from Joseph Campbell. Mm-hmm. You know, well, that's a great instruction. Follow your bliss. To me, following your bliss and following your emptiness are the same thing. They're about following that which is most alive in your life, and emptiness itself, even if it's painful,
but
can
Robert,
be alive.
Robert, I mean, if a person could talk themselves into doing crack and saying, I'm following my bliss, and I don't just mean this to be facetious, a person could say, I'm getting stoned, and that's following my bliss. If they could do that, how could you trust your own mind? How could you trust yourself to say, I'm following? Because bliss could be the biggest escape in the world from finding your real self. I mean, you can make up anything for bliss. I'm sure, I follow my bliss, it's in an alcohol bottle. I follow my bliss, it's in marijuana. I follow my bliss, it's in romance or it's in constant sex. You know, I think those could be easily addictions that are taking you away from self.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I think it needs a little more discipline than that. If you're going to follow your practice, there's got to be, I think it can't be as loose as, you know, take a walk in the woods. Unless you're walking
depends
a certain
what you
path
do.
On what you're doing. That's right.
Depends what you do when you get there.
That's right. That's right. What are you doing in the woods?
Right.
So what are you doing in the woods if you take a walk in the woods? It's not just taking a stroll, seeing if you could pick up somebody.
That's different. Right.
Right. So what's the intention? What do we need an intention?
You need to be able to be with yourself. You need to be able to let your mind be still.
So now we're saying take a walk in the woods, but let your mind be still.
Mm-hmm.
That means don't think anything.
It's impossible not to think anything.
Right, because you're going to be thinking about not thinking anything.
Exactly, right.
I understand.
But it is possible to slow it down and to begin to experience a deeper level of your own self.
My good friend Dita Scheiden, Pochi, Italy, by the way, if any of you ever want to go on a silent retreat, he runs these silent retreats. Now, what is a silent retreat? You go to Italy. You go on his farm, right, and he's got this number of people that are there, and everybody's in silence. That's what they do the whole time. They just get quiet. And they have a community of people who are just quiet. They never talk. Now, that's an interesting thing, being silent. And I know one discipline is for everyone to try. Try a day of silence. Just try one day of absolute silence. You speak to no one. Carry a little pad if you have to talk to people. If you have to say something to someone, you write it on a little pad. One day of silence is so enlightening, and then to include an hour of silence every day is amazing. An amazing new discipline. Now, if you take it a step further, what Dieter does there in the farm, which he showed me, is you move in slow motion. When walking through a wood, try walking in very slow motion. Walk at 1/5 or 1/10 the normal time you would walk. Move your hand in slow motion. Move your arms, move your eyes in slow motion. And by the slow motion, you begin to see so much and feel so much and become aware of so much. But these are disciplines. These are practices. These are curiosities. Things that you could do. You could squint your eyes and look at a candle and watch and let the candle dance in front of your eyes. Or you could close your eyes and only open them so much that you could only see out of the periphery of your eyes and watch what happens then. All of these are things that you do to try to get your mind to go to a place that it hasn't gone before. I had one exercise we did once with 100 people in a room. It was amazing. We went to a store, and I had done this workshop. We went to a store and we bought this mirror. These were mirror tiles. They were 1 foot by 1 foot. Did you ever see the little square mirrors you could, with adhesive tape, you put them on a wall? They're just very cheap. You get them at any paint store. They're called mirror tiles. 1 foot by 1 foot. We took these without putting them on a wall. We put them on the back of chairs. We had people sitting on a floor. In front of them, they took a plumber's candle, which is just those small white candles, just a small white 4-inch candle. And they had a plate under the candle. They lit the candle and they looked in their own eyes in the mirror. It was dark at night. It took about 3 hours for that candle to burn down. In the process, they were not allowed to move their eyes from looking at themselves. And they had to keep contact with only looking at themselves. But an interesting thing happened, because as the candle burned down, it cast a shadow upward. And as it cast the shadow upward, as you're looking at yourself in the mirror, you see yourself aging. Because the light going up makes you look like you're getting older. And you watch yourself literally, and your discipline is you will not move from this candle. And I tell you, friends, any of you out there who want to try this, do it on your own. It's great therapy. So you sit on the floor looking in a mirror tile on the back of a window. If you have a mirror you could put it up there big enough for your head. And you have a candle in between them. The candle's burning down, burning down, burning down. Then the candle gets very interesting because it forms a little pool at the bottom. And you never know exactly when it's going to go out, and it becomes like life itself. You never know when you're going to die. The candle keeps coming back, and every time you're sure it's over, it comes back and flickers alive again. Oh, my gosh, what an experience. 3 hours, sometimes 4 hours. And I watched 100 people do this, and they weren't allowed to move from looking at themselves for the entire time. I mean, they were allowed to, but they didn't. And, of course, I played some music in the background as this was going on. And then they just, after the experience, when the candle finally went out, they laid back and went to sleep. What a profound change the next day. These are things that are available for us. And if we're lucky, we find a good teacher. And if we're lucky, we learn to do these disciplines. You ask, what do you do at home? Most therapy, a person goes into therapy. Therapist says, I'll see you next week. Well, what do I do in between? Think about it. They don't have anything for a person to do. Give that person something to do, or do what Freud did. Have them come in 5 days a week and keep working, you know what I mean? Keep practicing it. You got three things now. Now, what's the next step for this, and able to do this journey? Community.
Right, exactly. You led right into that, because you're just talking about an experience of 100 people together. So it's really crucial to have a kind of practice that brings you into a community. You know, most of our lives are exactly like you mentioned earlier. We grow up pretty much thinking we have to do it alone. We can't trust anybody. And we have to do it by ourselves, including how we have a relationship. We'll manage a relationship and still be alone. Having a practice that takes us into community makes our spiritual growth really makes it possible. So the community is crucial to our spiritual growth. That's where we see all of our mishigas. That's where we, you know, do our thing and That's where we treat other people the way in our minds we're treating them all the time anyway. And that's where people then surprise us, because it's only in community that we give people a chance to act in a way that we did not expect them to. So we have to be open to that, and that'll be part of our own growth process.
You started this all by studying Jung, and then you went back to study, you studied others as well. But when you got to Jung, I mean, you started with Jung, I know. When you got to Jung, what did you, there's a man who had, Carl Gustav Jung, who is such an incredible mind, who wanted to see so much, trying to find out how we're going to do it through the archetypes. Are we going to figure out there are different types of, you know, people? Are we going to, trying every which way. And then Jung went himself on this incredible journey to try to find his own mind. For those of you who don't know, by the way, reading, let me just think, who wrote Siddhartha?
Hermann Hesse.
Hermann Hesse. Hermann Hesse's was in therapy with Jung. Did you know that, Robert?
Yes.
And you know, I guess it was Damien and Narcissus and Goldman are two books about his analysis with Jung. And you, if you read Narcissus and Goldman, you see that very essential question. Who is the teacher? You know? You know, and it, I guess...
It's
been a long time, but you remember the effect it had on
you?
Oh,
yeah,
you
very powerful. Right.
Powerful, profound book.
Right.
And he started off with Steppenwolf. Steppenwolf is the first book he wrote. The first book he wrote was about his possible death, was about considering suicide. And he went from Steppenwolf to Siddhartha and all the others, which is exactly the journey you're talking about for people. Because in a way, for us to journey into emptiness, we have to be willing to face death. Because that's the ultimate emptiness. That's what everybody thinks emptiness is equal to. That's why everybody fears death. What do? Just lay there and let the worms eat you? Is that the way it happens? That's the giant fear. The giant fear is the loss of everything, the absence of everything. It's not so much you're going to miss your mother and you're going to miss your father. You're going to be laying in that grave for all this time. And you have this emptiness. And then they talk about limbo as even being the worst place to be. You know, at least in purgatory or in hell, you get burned, and up in heaven, they're serving you a nice lunch. But limbo is is the worst place you could be, more emptiness. So I think that somewhere along the line, in order to make peace with this, you've got to make peace with death, do you think?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. That's part of why we're so afraid to sit still. That's part of why we're afraid of meditation. I mean, the example you gave of these people, you know, watching themselves in the mirror, they're facing their own dying, and we don't like that. That's very difficult.
We never give it much time.
We don't want to.
You know, we don't want to, because as if to consider it would be to make it happen.
Right.
You know, well, why don't I just think about being rich then if I have that much power? Right, all I have to do is consider it and it'll happen. It's Armand DeMille here. It's Robert Gunn. I wish we had more time, Robert. I did want to finish that question about Jung, though.
I had a comment about the community business and as it relates to Jung. Jung was very strong to say that a whole bunch of people is a collective, and that's not what we mean by community. Community means intentional people relating in ways that support your own self-development and your growth. So it's important to have people around you who help you to support who you are, to support your own being.
And what if you have people around you who are saying, who are antagonistic to your being? What do you do? I mean, is the first step move out? I mean, if you've got, let's say you've got a husband who's saying, what are you doing wearing those funny robes?
You need to declare a safety zone to find some place where you feel safe to be yourself. And with the help of a teacher and a practice, you can learn what to do with those critical people.
Yeah, and we're always trying. Armand DeMille, Robert Gunn, author of the book, The Journey into Emptiness, a very interesting book about studying the lives and the teachings of Dogen, Merton, Jung, and through that, trying to find a way to learn a little more about ourselves. I guess everything we could do, you know, to find out more, that's the best we could do. This is Armand DeMille with you. We're going to have to be going right now, my friends. If you wanted to hear today's program again, you could go to WBAI.org, or you can go to thepositivemind.com, where you will hear a lot of archives And you could send an email also to Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D, at thepositivemind.com. I'd love to hear from you and hear your reaction. Be back with you soon, my friends.